On the political background of It Finally Happened, this work is a rebuke to low ambition. It is written against that most dreary and persistent habit of modern politics. The habit of mistaking the minimum for the magnificent. Again and again, public life invites us to applaud what ought never to have required applause at all. Danger is blatantly acknowledged, a harm partially restrained, an outrage mildly reduced. And the governing class steps forward as though history itself has been made anew. It is in that atmosphere that this piece should be heard. Its immediate occasion is the celebration of a generational smoking ban, a measure presented as bold, historic, even epical. The underlying argument of this work is not that such a ban is wrong, nor trivial in itself, but that it is tragically insufficient as a measure of national seriousness. Children should, of course, be protected from tobacco. They should also have been protected from lead, from poisoned water, from industrial filth, from chemical negligence, from the slow violence of environments known to be dangerous and left dangerous all the same. Wisdom should have done it. Science should have done it. Conscience should have done it. None of these things should ever have matured into issues at all. And that is precisely the point. A civilization ought not congratulate itself too warmly for forbidding the obviously harmful. That is not grandeur. That is not vision. That is not the summit of political morality. It's the floor! The true scandal lies elsewhere. That while one preventable vice is denounced with ceremony, the larger architecture of degradation remains not merely standing, but managed, tolerated, and explained away. Children may be spared the cigarette and still be handed hunger. They may be protected from smoke and abandoned to mold. They may be instructed not to inhale poison while being raised in conditions that corrode dignity just as surely. Shame on you! They may be saved from one commercial predation, only to be delivered into another. The landlord, the debt trap, the cold room, the narrowed school, the anxious home, the future rationed by income before character has had the chance to form. This work refuses to accept that such a condition is politically serious merely because it is administratively familiar. The deepest claim made here is a simple one. Human beings require great things if they are to be sustained as great beings. They require more than management, more than subsistence, more than the cold charity of being kept barely alive and nominally legal. They require the material basis of dignity, nourishment, warmth, rest, effective education, health, beauty, confidence, and a horizon not perpetually darkened by deprivation and chance of war. Mark my words, little man. A child is not a unit to be kept from vice while being left exposed to want. A child is the beginning of a civilization. The measure of a nation is therefore not what dangers it forbids in the abstract, but what fullness of life it is prepared to guarantee in fact. That is why the end of poverty stands here as the nobler horizon, as the proper business of a decent state. There is, after all, something almost vulgar in the smallness of contemporary ambition. We are asked to marvel when governments do late and partially what they ought to have done early and completely. We are told to revere incremental gestures in a land of immense wealth and immense wasted human possibility. We are instructed, above all, to be realistic. That wretched word by which moral laziness acquires the costume of wisdom. Realism, in this degraded sense, means asking children to adjust themselves to a world that was designed without sufficient love and wisdom, and then praising power for making that world fractionally less cruel. This work declines that bargain, you incompetent little man! It insists that politics must be judged not by its talent for tidying up the edges of barbarism, but by its willingness to abolish the conditions that make barbarism ordinary. No, you foul-mouthed contrarians. It does not sneer at public health reform. It merely refuses to mistake reform for redemption. It does not deny the value of restraint. It denies that restraint alone deserves triumphal language. It asks, with some anger and no apology, why the state finds such ease in regulating one hazard, while displaying such chronic timidity before the ancient scandal of poverty. For poverty in a rich society is not misfortune in the pure sense. It is policy, endured long enough to masquerade as nature, It is organized smallness. It is the reduction of human possibility to a budget line. It is the farming of entire classes of people into anxiety, utility, and silence. And any politics that leaves this intact while congratulating itself on lesser achievements deserves not hymns, but challenge. Hence the tone. It carries celebration, yes, but celebration of a far greater idea than the one that prompted it. It cherishes not the modest reform, but the possibility of a nation finally thinking in proportion to its own children. It imagines a country that does not merely prohibit the obvious harm, but sets itself to the noblest available task. To ensure that no child's life is bent small by want, humiliation, or preventable suffering. That would be the beginning worthy of bells. That would be an event worthy of history. That would be the work of great beings. That would be something more than competent administration or tidy reform. It would be a proper declaration that the purpose of society is not merely to keep disorder within acceptable limits, but to raise human life to its proper stature. Until then, every lesser triumph must stand under great suspicion, not celebration. For this is, in the end, a rebuke to low ambition and a demand that public life recover the courage to describe the names it so readily gives itself. Justice, responsibility, knowledge, wisdom, greatness, progress, nation.